So I think, see if I can concert, but I had a kind of fractious day. So I thought about Concom about 5:30 to 7:30 this morning, but haven't thought about him since. So we'll see if I think it's there. But here's my strategy. I think what I want to do is do the second and third paralogisms, then turn to the argument, and I'm sure you have Keen right on top of your head. We ended with last time on the problem of spontaneity. We're back to that. And that argument, it turns out, will in fact be a version of the argument of paragraph 16 of the B deduction. So we will magically be in the midst of the B deduction, which is, I guess, how one wants to live one's life. That seems to me a procedure. That's a better idea. Okay, so let's say yes, open the text. The text for our sermon today. Second paralogism. A351, that the action, which can never be regarded as the concurrence of several things acting, is simple. Now the soul or the thinking eye is such a being, therefore, etc. And Kant says of this that this is the Achilles of all dialectical inferences in the pure doctrine of the soul. Which is to say, he thinks it's the one that really gets us close to the center of the issues. And the argument that he runs something like, just to repeat some material from last time, that we can represent a subject of representations only from a subject's point of view. That's the thought here. Let me get clear. It's very important that for Kant, there is no ultimately no adequate third person perspective on first person experience. That if you have an outsider's point of view, if you think about other people's behavior, then you're not thinking about them as subject in a way, you're thinking about them as object. So you're sitting there, and if you're looking at me, then you're probably thinking, oh, he would say something like that. That's objectification. That's not seeing it from the inside, that's seeing it from the outside, right? That is, you're seeing it as part of what phenomenal regularity. To see it from the inside means to put myself in the other's place. And that part of this comes from the fact that the I think, as we suggested last time, is an experience, but not experience sensitive. That is, again, try to get that curious thought, that when that each of us has the experience of being the subject of thoughts, the subject of judgment. I judge the wall is white, and that's an awareness of the wall from the first person point of view. Okay. Now, I have that sense of it as from the first person point of view. That's why it's an experience. There's a real experience here. However, it's not an experience which has any discriminatory features. That is, it's not as if I could also judge the wall from a non-first person point. In other words, there's nothing about it that would allow me to discriminate it from something else. That is, it has no complex empirical characteristics which themselves could be objects of judgment. So the very nature of the I think has about it both an experiential but also an irreducible character. What do I want to say? It doesn't pick out any. I mean, when we judge a thing, we can say it's, you know, red and, you know, not yellow or blue or whatever, right? So we pick out the red. But when I do the I think, I'm not picking it out as against you thinking it. Right? That's part of what makes the I think literally both experiential and transcendental at the same time. That is not part of the experience we judge about, but an experience that is a condition for the possibility of experience. Hence the notion that it is not experience sensitive. The concept of thinking, put it another way, is that of a being having experiences. The idea of a concept thinking being is that of a being having experiences. To put it again in the final way, Kant says at A350, there's no intuition here that I bring under a concept. He says, right? Famously, the I is indeed in all thoughts, but there is not in this representation the least trace of intuition distinguishing the I from other objects of intuition. In other words, I'm thinking, no, it's the elephant that's thinking. No, I can't make that mistake. Right? So what we say is that the I, if you're an analytic philosopher, we often say things like, the I almost is not quite a referring expression, because with other indexicals, we can ask about which object. And so I say, it's blue. What's it? He's jealous. Who? Yeah, they came marching down Fifth Avenue. There's always a possibility of discrimination. But you can say, when I say, I'm thinking, and you say to me, who's thinking? I mean, of course you could be thinking I'm brainwashed, but it's not, apart from something ironical. So we often say the pronoun I cannot fail to hit its target. You can't mistake the I for something else. Well, of course, you can make a mistake about any other object of experience. So there is something really extraordinary about the I, which, of course, is what the cogito ergo sum is all about, right? That was Descartes' point. This is all kind of rough and ready Cartesianism. So it follows that we cannot form pictures of ourselves except as a unity. If I got no distinguishing features, I'm not an I but a tiger, no, I'm just I, then there's nothing that distinguishes me. There's no characteristics, there's no features, nothing discriminates. But if there's nothing discriminate, then I can think of it as complex or composite. Therefore, if I cannot think of it as complex or composite, then I can't think of it as anything other than a unity, namely a single subject of representations. So the thought is that because our picture of the I thing, and it's really wonderful how phenomenological this bit of Kant is, isn't it? It's trying to do really phenomenology of what's going on here. Because our picture of the I thing somehow leads us to the idea that the unity we picture is incompatible with compositeness. Let me say that again, because it's this whole structure of this argument is very Wittgensteinian, because it's all about pictures, and how pictures lead us astray. It's that our picture of the I thing, because it's, has no discriminatory characteristics to it, leads us to the idea that the unity we picture, notice now I've turned the subject into object, the unity we picture in thinking about us as the subject of representations, the unity we picture, is incompatible with compositeness, with complexity, with difference, with empirical characteristics. Think of, an example. One of the ways that people play with this is using locking thought experiments. That I walk through a machine and I'm bifurcated, right? Half of me now will go off and live in deepest, darkest Peru, and the other bit of me is going to live in Bed-Stuy, or something like that. Now here's the thing. If you think of the division actually happening, you assume you must identify with one of them and not the other. You can conceive of them as both being you. That is, if the division happens, you don't think, oh, well, I'm here and I'm there. No. You think, no. Some bit of me became, but I... So again, the way we picture ourselves is always in this irreducible, unified way. So Kant says, A352, he does it in a slightly different way. For suppose it be the composite that thinks, then every part of it would be part of the thought, and only all of them taken together would contain the whole thought. Notice, this is just our problem of the I thing must accompany all our representations again, why this unity happens. So he says, but this cannot consistently maintained for representations, for instance, the single words of a verse, distributed among different beings, never make up a whole thought, a verse, and it is therefore impossible that a thought should inhere in what is essentially composite. Right? It can't be that bits of me thing, whose woods these are, I think I know. And another me, bit of me thinks, but his house is in the village, though, because that I want oneself, right, to be the self of the whole poem, holding all the verse together, surveying the whole, unifying it. And therefore, its unity presupposes my transcendental unity. It is therefore possible only in a single substance, which not being an aggregate of many, is absolutely simple. That, of course, is a false inference. I want to be clear here, this whole argument is fallacious. And the fallaciousness of it, what's the fallaciousness of it? You're all now knee-deep in Kant. Why is it a fallacious inference? You think you're simple? Nothing meant by that.
Can you repeat the question?
Why is the argument I've just been giving you fallacious?
Is it that you distinguish the unity from that which is unified, from the unifying activity of certain...
Say more.
Well, I think that the whole line of it is to criticize a certain substantialization of the I. So there is a certain synthesizing activity of, etc.
Right. So what we're doing, in Kantian jargon, which I'm going to skip, but Kantian jargon is we're conflating the transcendental with the empirical. The human way of discussing it is to say that the I thing, right, is a function, that is, it represents the point of view of synthesizing activity. So it's a necessary presupposition for the possibility of experience is that the I think must accompany all my representations, right? That's the point of view in which they are held together in a unified perspective. It's the unified perspective that makes us think the point of view unifying them is one. But we take the oneness of unity seen and transfer it into the object so it becomes the unity of seer. That is, you make the activity into a thing. It's a work of reification. You transform the activity of unification into a substance that itself is simple and non-differentiable. But there's no reason to think that there is such a simple substance. So so Kant says, A355, just find it. So what Kant thinks here is that what this is, and it's very important, the origin of this thought, simplicity and substance of the soul, very classical doctrine, has always been about the transcendental unity of apperception. So he says, I am simple means nothing more than that this representation, I, does not contain in itself the least manifoldness, and that it is absolute, although merely logical unity. It's the logical unity of the I thing becomes the substantial unity of the notion of an ego or self or whatever you want to call it, or soul. And indeed, if you think it's simple, you might even think it has to be immaterial, which is why the notion of simplicity is so important here, because simplicity would seem, non-compositeness is incompatible with spatial extension, because it's non-divisible, and if non-divisible, then non-material, ergo, if I'm simple, I'm non-material, and therefore, and then you can go on and do all your wonderful traditional metaphysics of the soul. But Kant says, no, no. None of that follows. None of that follows. Thus, the renowned psychological proof, this is just continuing from the same place, is founded merely on the indivisible unity of a representation, which governs only the verb in its relation to a person. The thing. I think X. It is obvious that attaching I to our thoughts, we designate the subject of inherence only transcendentally. And now you can say only functionally, not metaphysically. Where transcendental is something we must presuppose, something, a job that must be carried out, but tells us nothing about the metaphysical substance. Without noting in it any quality whatsoever, in fact, without knowing anything of it either by direct acquaintance or otherwise. So this is a claim of, I'll say more about this in a moment, both metaphysical neutrality and noumenal ignorance. Metaphysically neutral, because Kant is claiming here at least that it has no implications for materialism, immaterialism, any of your big metaphysical theses. Just doesn't matter. If, to repeat a slogan of mine, function replaces substance, then we don't know anything about substance. So substantial characterizations, materialism, idealism, soulism, all these kind of things all just vaporize. So the simple way, again, of thinking about this is that the I am simple simply derives from the fact that the I think provides an awareness of features that could not be split. That's how the illusion arises. Okay. Any questions about this second paralogism? Why is Kant doing this? Because he's trying again to dig away at the idea of what it means to think transcendentally. And why transcendental philosophy, the Copernican turn, is both a critique of metaphysics, and therefore a freeing of us from dogmatic illusion. We are suddenly free if... So notice, there's a ground to the second paralogism. We have all the reason in the world to think that the soul is simple. It captures something important about the I think. Namely, it's an experience without features that can be split apart and divided. So there's a real structural reason. And the inference to simplicity and therefore immateriality is false. So he's left, and now here's the awkward moment. He's left the door open to transcendent materialism. I'll come back to that. They say that door shouldn't be so open. Third paralogism. Any questions? Third paralogism. That which is conscious of the numerical identity of itself at different times is, insofar, a person. Now the soul is conscious of its numerical identity of itself at different times, therefore it is a person. What is he worried about here? He's worried about the problem of personal identity. And what he's worried about is the question of what we might call strict identity of person through time. That is the thought that a person remains the very same person necessarily throughout all of his or her experiences. And you'll find arguments to this effect all over the place in both empiricism and rationalism. Bishop Butler, in his Analogy of Religion, writes, every person is conscious that he is the same person or self as far back as his memory reaches. Since when anyone reflects upon a past action of his own, he is just as certain of the person who did the action, namely himself, the person who now reflects upon it, as he is certain that the action was at all done. So, Butler is saying, well, look, when I think back to my conversation this afternoon, and I think, I really said that to her? I don't have any doubt that it was me doing the same, right? It's not as if my memory, oh, no, it wasn't me who said it. I'm as certain that it was me as that terrible thing was said. Here's a kind of empiricist realist named Reed from Essays on the Intellectual Powers of Man. Reed says, the conviction which every man has of his identity, as far back as his memory reaches, needs no aid of philosophy to strengthen it. This is Reed in his aggressive, experience will take us right to the world mood. And no philosophy can weaken it without first producing some degree of insanity. My personal identity implies a continued existence of that indivisible, i.e. simple, thing which I call myself. Where does this argument go? Anyone? Kind of do metaphysics? Strict identity? It's one of the presuppositions for arguments for the immortality of the soul. Because if the self is going to be differentiated and not strict identity, then there's no soul that can survive. So if I'm going to survive my death, then I better be me who survives it, not someone else. I want to benefit from all this. And therefore, there's a requirement for strict identity. So the argument really goes, requirements for the immortality of the soul are personal identity, that is, it's me throughout the whole history of my existence, and that identity is absolute, not relative. Think of Hume, right? Where the identity of the self is relative. Well, I don't know if you've read, but Parfit has numerous articles showing that the identity of self is relative, more like the identity of, I can't bear to say it, a baseball team like the Yankees, right? I so hate the Yankees. But anyway, the Yankees stay the same, although the personnel changes. They go on, they keep winning, they keep making money, they keep being the rich guys, but it has no strict identity, right? Because its contents changes. So the self can't be like that, although Parfit and Hume argue it is, has strict identity. And that is, along with simplicity, allows it to survive death. So these ideas are deep in that they, go right to the heart of the classical metaphysical conceptions of soul. Well, Kant wants to say that memory does not yield knowledge of identity, let alone strict identity. Kant's question would be, when an earlier subject appears in memory to be me and no one else, is it logically or necessarily true that it is me? can't answer is no. So, in my family, we have an ongoing argument because my sister has an absolute memory of breaking her arm. And everyone, every time she mentions, everyone looks at her like she's nuts. You didn't break your arm. Jay broke his arm. But she's certain, right? Because she has the memory of the arm breaking, and it was hers, that because it's her memory of that, she can't be wrong. But of course, we can be mistaken in memory whether it was us or not, especially in activities that involve a group of people. You know, we did this, and I said, no, maybe it wasn't me who said that. Someone much braver than me. Okay. But yet, when we say these things, and now here's the puzzle, so let's go back to the puzzle and how it gets generated, we feel absolutely certain. How come? Where does that experience come from? Well, I get an impression of identity of subject in cases where I have, where an earlier representation is available to me because I remember having had an earlier impression. So my sister has the memory of herself breaking her arm. And because she is now remembering having an earlier impression, namely the impression of her arm breaking, therefore she assumes that it was her arm that broke. And the reason why this occurs, it's that memory always occurs from the inside. The identity, this is A363, the identity of the consciousness of myself at different times is therefore a formal condition of my thoughts, and they are coherent and in no way proves the numerical identity of my subject. Despite the logical identity of the I experienced X, I remember experiencing X. Despite the logical identity of the I, such a change may have occurred in it as does not allow the retention of its identity, and yet we may ascribe to it the same sounding I, which in every state, even in one involving change of the thinking subject, might still retain the thought of the preceding subject, and so hand it over to the subsequent subject. So, what's the argument? Our sense of identity across time is engendered by assuming a strict parallel with present case experience, and then simply extending it. So, one, I perceive the circle. Case two, I perceive the whole poem. Aware of myself. So we think of two as a simply an extended version of one, right? That just in the way I gather and I'm the unified subject of perceiving the circle, so I am the, over time, even a short poem, extended subject of reading two, and then we have, say, the third case, reading remembrance of things past. And we think that reading remembrance of things past is like, right? The poem, like seeing the circle, and then we think any past event remembered. So we draw these series of widening analogies of carrying experience over time. And what allows us to do that is that memories themselves are always in the present. A memory from the past is not in the past, it's in the present. And therefore, we kind of forget that fact and think of an extended, a present, an extended present, a present with a past, and then a memory from a far past as all versions of the same, and of course they are not. I do, after all, remember having experiences I have not had. You have. But, and this is important, there is no parallel in the present. So that present experience at a certain moment, even if extended, then really does morph into something else. Right? So the self, as it carries through time, is not like the self at a time. And again, part of the reason this happens is that, and this is the impression of depth, of which, I mean, I mentioned this, right? Because Remembrance of Things Past is about this. It starts with this. Madeleine is that now experience shoots up the past, collapses that, right? Which is becomes the trigger for the extended meditation that is the book itself. And the impression of depth is created because acts of memory place the intentional objects of memory in the past. So when Marcel remembers Maman, right, he doesn't have the sense of Maman present, he has the sense of Maman, and he was hiding. But that's a projection of a present memory into a past, not the stretching of himself into that past. And again, you can think about that phenomenon as again, just another version of having to see things from the first person point of view. Right? Another trick of that fact that to see things is from the first person. Okay. Well, from all this, standard accounts of Kant say that Kant is committed to three theses. Empirical dualism, by which he means in the empirical phenomenal world, there are minds and there are bodies. Noumenal ignorance, namely, we do not know what the true substance of mind or world is. We don't know what lies behind the appearances. We know appearances are not things themselves, and that includes the self too. Right? And hence, metaphysical neutrality. Since we don't know what's going on down there in the darkest noumenal world, then it follows that the entire Kantian metaphysics of experience is metaphysically neutral. It makes no claims about what there is or must be. Now, this is where last time Gabe got exacerbated and challenged, and he was right to do so. The question is this true? Is the theory metaphysically neutral? And if it's not metaphysically neutral, then two could be false as well. So there really is a lot at stake here. Is the Kantian system, so if metaphysical neutrality is false, then so might be noumenal ignorance. Well, most of the deep evidence for metaphysical neutrality comes from the paralogisms. Which is why we've just been slogging through them. It had to be a reason. Part of it was to try to think about what the I think means, and how Kant thinks about it. But part of it is, he thinks about it in part as getting clear the commitments of transcendental versus metaphysical forms of thought. And therefore, he seems to think, and this is the weight of the whole paralogisms, that the paralogisms consistently block immaterialism, idealism, indeed what you may call any obviously metaphysically anti-materialist argument. Because after all, it's the rational psychologists who suggest the paralogistic arguments. The rational psychologists are the ones who are going to defend the immortality of the soul and all that stuff. Kant doesn't want that. So in knocking down the arguments of the rational psychologists, he equally knocks down traditional anti-materialism, which means sub specie eternitas, the argument must go, metaphysical neutrality is real, and sub specie eternitas, Kantian metaphysics of experience, is compatible with materialism. for those of you who are readers of Wilfred Sellers, this is how Sellers aims to get at his two images of man. One as living in a phenomenal world, and then Kant's wrong, we get at materialism too. Okay, well, is Kant right? Well, the suggestion I was making at the end of the last time was that there are a whole bunch of passages on spontaneity that undermine Kant's claim for formalism. So the thesis I'm trying to suggest, and the argument is, it's in your bibliography from Bob Pippin's article on Kant on spontaneity, that what Kant has to say about the spontaneity of the subject is incompatible with his own formalism, therefore incompatible with metaphysical neutrality, therefore incompatible with noumenal ignorance. So, there are these whole bunches of passages. I suggested B158, the footnote on the bottom. Let me just read it and I'll read another passage. The other places are the long footnote at B422, a long passage at B5745, but let's look at B158. Always seems to be the nicest one, which I read to you last time, or someone read out last time. And it says a lot, as I mentioned last time, that two of these passages, right, are footnotes. Which are very long footnotes. Long footnotes can mean a lot of different things. In Kant, it's always a sign of anxiety. In my writings, it's always a sign that the whole text doesn't say what I want to say. That footnote where I really get serious. Now, people who read me will only read my footnotes. Let's skip the text. Read Brinson's book. Okay. So Kant says, the I think expresses the act of determining my existence. Existence is already given thereby, but the mode in which I am to determine this existence, that is, the manifold belonging to it, is not thereby given. So it's the act of determining. If you're Husserl, you think about the I think means I can. It's one way of getting at the idea of determining. I can, so if we're, you know, I think is like, I can lift the bottle, look at the watch, do this, do that. It's the act of determining, not the thing determined. Potentiality. In order that it be given, Kant says, self-intuition. Self-intuition. What's that kind of talk? Self-intuition is required, and such intuition is conditioned by a given a priori form, namely time, which is sensible and belongs to the receptivity of the determinable in me. Now, since I do not have another self-intuition, which gives the determining in me, I am conscious only of the spontaneity of it prior to the act of determination. So the determining, that's what he's saying here, when I am aware I can lift the bottle, lift the watch, think the thought, I do not have a thought of a previous determining, determining that determining. So there's something original absolute about that determining. It has no anticipation. Now, since I do not have another self-intuition which gives the determining in me prior to the act of determination, as time does in the case of the determinable, so this is not like a temporal series, I can determine my existence as that of a self-active being. What's self-active there?
Self-taken.
Right. Self-activity, self-taken-kite, which I'll come to in a minute, which is, I guess, one of Fichte's famous phrases. This is Fichte in Moment and Kant, as I suggested. So I'm aware of myself as self-active. All that I can do is to represent to myself the spontaneity of my thought. That is of the determination. And my existence is still only determinable sensibly. That is, as the existence of an appearance. But it is owing to this spontaneity that I entitle myself intelligence. So, there is something that the story of the paralogism does not get at in terms of the I think. And that is, every act of I think is a determining a self-activity. And a self-activity that, and here's the crux of the matter, is this is one thing, or this is the thesis that I want to urge, this is one thing that can never be phenomenal. That is, cannot be reduced to a moment in a causal series. But if the I think cannot be reduced, cannot be phenomenal, then the I think is not metaphysically neutral. Now, the thought here is that the property of spontaneity, which is, again, that in virtue of which I call myself an intelligence, can never be a kind of property a merely phenomenal subject could logically have. So spontaneity is incompatible with phenomenality. But now Kant it's not that Kant's unaware of this. He just wants to say, and now I'm going to try to dig a little further, he simply wants to say that the subject of experience, to say that the subject of experience is not exclusively phenomenal, is not equivalent to proving that it is a thing in itself. That's the whole work of the paralogism. So let me repeat that. Kant wants to say over and over again that demonstrating that the subject of experience cannot be exclusively phenomenal is not equivalent to proving that it is a thing in itself. And that should not be inconsistent with the claim that the self is completely unknowable. Now, what I'm urging against this is that there is a hedging here And the reason that the hedging slides past is because of illegitimate segregation. So this is Bernstein versus the Kantian Board of Education. It is not separate but equal. And what's not separate but equal is the relation between text and footnote. And why, what goes on is, what's missing in, what brings the text and the footnotes together is this. The act of spontaneity that he says cannot be regarded as belonging to sensibility, is what he elsewhere calls pure apperception. So, if his argument is that all thinking is apperceiving, and I'm going to suggest that is what he is claiming, then he must claim that all thinking is spontaneous, and therefore he must claim that all thinking is incompatible with phenomenality, and therefore he must claim that we know at least one thing about the thing in itself, namely, it can't be material. So, why do problems arise here? They arise because apperception and therefore spontaneity is implicit in every thinking and not explicit. Now, I mean by that two things. I first mean that, and it's the kind of obvious one, that the I thing must be able to accompany all my representations in part means that the I think is involved in every thinking, even when we are not explicitly aware of it. Now, the question of explicit awareness is, I think, what leads to all the problems, because what's really going on here is a series of misinterpretations of what Kant means by apperception. I have been suggesting, now get back to where we're kind of heading, that apperception is not self-awareness. I said to apperceive is not to be aware of myself, to have some idea of myself, to be thinking about myself. I have further said, repeatedly, that apperception is not an act of self-identification. I must be aware of myself as different from the things that surround me. All that stuff in Strawson and Bennett. So this is the self-awareness argument. This is Dieter Henrich. Dieter Henrich really does think, and this is why I think, by the way, Dieter Henrich actually misreads Fichte as well. That self-awareness really is an awareness of self. He thinks apperception is an awareness of the self. Nor is it Strawson and others' self-identification as opposed to being able to discriminate myself from the objects around me. Rather, I have claimed apperception is non-isolatable and that it is the adverbial character of all mental activity, namely, I apperceptively perceive, think, imagine, or in my way of putting it out, I judge the world from a particular first-person point of view. But there's no thought of the self there. Rather, it's implied, implicit in, right, the act of judgment itself as its condition of possibility. So, of course, we are not normally consciously aware of our spontaneity. Indeed, if we were, ordinary life would be intolerable. What we're aware of is the object of awareness. I'm awareness of Karen. I'm not awareness of my seeing, judging them, right? I mean, if you're aware like that, right? That's what it means to be self-conscious. The I think is, and Sartre had this just right, is absolute world awareness, but from a point of view. But if that's right, that shows how it's implicit. But what's implicit, if pure apperception is the same as spontaneity, then the notion of spontaneity as the metaphysical bearer of judgment is a necessary condition for the possibility of experience, and metaphysical neutrality and noumenal ignorance are false. QED. Is that something I can offer? Gabe?
I'm just wondering, I'm kind of getting all these spontaneity, self-intuition, pure apperception. Seems like a lot of them are collapsing into spontaneity. Because in the footnote, Kant says that that it's a self-intuition of spontaneity.
But then what he's actually talking about, so I'm not denying that there are self-intuitions of spontaneity. I can. That's why I use the kind of Husserlian I can. Kant's example is attention. I shift my attention from one object to another. I attend. That's spontaneous. What my argument was is that he isolates that moment of spontaneity into this explicit awareness of it, as if it was not implied everywhere else in the text. So my way of trying to answer your question was to say Kant's other name for spontaneity is pure apperception. And pure apperception doesn't have that notion of explicit awareness. Indeed, it usually does not, hence gets buried, gets lost, and then you may think that the two things are separate. My awareness of my freedom on the one hand, my judging another, and spontaneity in the I think gets separated out. I'm saying if that passage and the ones like it mean anything, they must be about the I think itself. But the I think in its normal form is non-isolatable. It's the wall was white. Right, which is I judge the wall is white. Does that answer your, I mean, I know you want to pull out something fatter. What do you need something fatter for? Go skinny. This is New York. You don't want to kind of like be a Georgian and have a big fat.
From Texas.
Oh, Texas. I'm sorry.
Everything's bigger.
Everything's bigger in Texas, even the self.
Oh, that's for sure.
This is degenerate. Yeah.
Yeah. To go from another perspective. Why don't we end up with these problems when you make apperception of when you make our awareness of spontaneity pure apperception?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we end up with?
No, I don't do that. Remember something else. My awareness of spontaneity, I'm agreeing, is a separable experience. My claim is that experience, to see the depth of the meaning of spontaneity, however, is to see that it's present in all experience qua apperceptive. So my claim is spontaneity qua experience is what's called an isolatable experience. It is one of those moments where we attend to the determining and not what's determined. And there's a pleasure in that. Hey, I can do it. I can remember the whole poem. I'm not thinking about the poem, I'm thinking about my power. But normally, but I want to say what that experience in the first case is an experience of is the same thing that's there in every judgment. But I want to deny that there's any experience of the spontaneity in those cases. That they're just sublimated away. Correctly. That's why I gave the Sartre, right? You know, Sartre has that great passage in Transcendence of the Ego, where there's a very fine book on Sartre, which kind of compares Sartre's I think to Kant's by, what's her name? Interesting, kind of writer. But Sartre has a great experience where he says, you know, when I'm aware of the road in the heat, you know, I'm out there in the dust, in the road, feeling the dryness, the heat. I'm not aware of myself. That's right. And yet no one could have a gentle conception of subjectivity than Sartre, right? Pure negativity, nothingness. Maybe a little too far. Yeah?
Can you explain what the metaphysical claim is now when you say it's transcendental materialism? I'm just not seeing how that follows.
I'm not saying it's not immaterialism, I'm saying it's anti-materialist. It's that we cannot have a purely causal conception of subjectivity. That there's no room for neutrality or ignorance here. This is are never going to be able to detach ourselves from the claim of the spontaneity of the subject. So Kant, I think, fought too hard to neutralize his what he was up to. Tried to make it all into modes, into function without substance. What I'm saying here is a little bit of substance sneaking back in.
namely the spontaneity of the self, as how we necessarily must conceive of ourselves in a manner that is logically and transcendentally incompatible with phenomenality, that is, causal accounts of the nature of experience. So, I mean, let me give an example. So, who else tries to do the metaphysical neutrality? Well, Dennett's the obvious example, right? What is intentionality for Dennett? Anyone? The stance. You take an intentional stance. And he calls it the stance, right? He says you can treat any domain as either an intentional system or a causal system, and that's simply a descriptive choice. And I want to say, well, what kind of being can take up that kind of stance? Who can be a stance, right? And I think that's not metaphysically neutral. That's the spontaneity I'm claiming it's going to get back in and defeat the claim that it's a matter of stance only. So you can see Dennett as a kind of successor of Kantian neutrality. And if you're a Kantian, you wouldn't want to go that way. Because down that line really is a belief in materialism. Okay, you're looking either intrigued, dumbfounded, or bored. Let's leave it at that. Let's have a break, and then we'll the handout I've given you, 2-page handout, just one. It's the entire V deduction, an outline of it, not by me, but I think it's a good outline.